Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So Oscar season is just about upon us, and we're asking today how important the PR campaigns are, how much of a factor are they, the behind-the-scenes manoeuvres when it comes to winning an Academy Award. And we're going to talk about all of the skullduggery that can go on and discuss some of the more controversial Oscar winners over the years with Adam Maguire from the RTE Business Desk and film critic Brian Lloyd. Lovely to see you both. Thank you for being here. So Adam, the nominees and the winners, these are the films that the Academy thinks are most deserving.
Of course.
Discuss.
Of course. Yeah. You know, there is, though, a large, sophisticated and expensive machine in place, so funded largely by the movie studios, that help encourage the Academy members to make the right choice, basically. Because one of the large unseen parts of the Oscar process is the campaign, where studios spend millions of dollars trying to get films nominated and ultimately try and get them to win a trophy as well. Estimated more than $500 million spent on campaigning each year. So for context, that's about the same as the combined budgets of the 10 Best Picture nominees this year. So even in Hollywood standards, it's a huge amount of money.
And what is a campaign? What does it look like?
Well, there are specific consultants in Hollywood who specialise in securing awards and victories and nominations. And their work usually starts a year or maybe even more before the Oscar ceremony itself, possibly before the film has even started shooting, because the studios are thinking really well in advance about what films have what it takes to be in the mix for an award. They'll want to ensure they time the release correctly, maybe have it debut right at the right film festival, so they start building early buzz. There's, you know, this term Oscar bait for a film that seems to be designed specifically to bag an Oscar, because the Academy kind of has a preference for different types of films. Like, it likes period dramas, it likes war movies, and it especially likes films about Hollywood and about showbiz. And if a film is released later in the year, it's fresher in the mind of the awards voters, who have to submit their votes in early or mid-January. And if a film is released under an independent or a specialist sub-brand of a big studio, that's often a sign that they're targeting the Oscars with this film.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about how it works, but Brian, for you, like, when did this start? When did we first see this begin? Is it a recent phenomenon?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I would suppose the one that people kind of talk about when they come to think of Oscar campaigns, they think of Shakespeare in Love. And this was where you had Harvey Weinstein, the famed producer, now kind of, you know, disgraced
in
criminal, in prison, rightfully so. He basically set out to ensure that Shakespeare in Love would get as many nominations as it possibly could. Mm-hmm. And he kind of crafted this entire campaign where he would, you know, have people in Shakespearean costumes arrive up to people's house to deliver screeners of the film. He would host these really extravagant parties where he would bring in, you know, cast members to kind of, you know, schmooze with everyone else. And on top of that as well, he would book out, you know, advertising in the likes of, you know, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Deadline Hollywood. And that really became the blueprint then for all future FYC campaigns. That's for your consideration campaigns. That's the industry.
That's what they call them.
That's what they call them, yeah, FYC campaigns. And, you know, it was successful because, I mean, Shakespeare in Love swept the board at the Oscars that year, and it won out over the likes of Saving Private Ryan. Cate Blanchett was expected to win for her role in Elizabeth. It obviously went to Gwyneth Paltrow. A lot of people felt sick about that. And in fact, I think it was 2015, The Hollywood Reporter polled all of the Oscar voters from that year and put it to them, okay, if you could vote again, would you still vote for Shakespeare in Love as Best Picture? And I think like 75% of them said they would have voted for Saving Private Ryan.
Easy to say after the fact when they've given the Oscar.
Yeah, hindsight's a great thing, yeah.
So then let's go back to the campaign itself, Adam. So let's say a film has a bit of film festival buzz around it. People are talking about it. What do the studios do? They mobilise at that stage.
Yeah, this is when the campaign proper kind of starts, because it's at this point they really try and start to get noticed by the Academy voters. And the thing is, people probably don't realise the barrier to getting a nomination is a lot lower than you might think. There's just over 9,900 members of the Academy at the moment, and they all vote on their pick of nominees to decide who wins. But that's phase two. That's when you have all the nominees. Phase one sees each branch of the Academy voting for their category. So the actor branch will vote for the best actor nominations. The directors will vote for best director and so on. And the actor branch is the biggest of them all. It has 1,258 members or so. So if you have five nominees in the best actor category, country, mm-hmm. assuming everyone eligible votes, that means you only need 252 votes to get a nomination for an Oscar. So it's a really, really low number. Yeah, you only really turn a couple of heads is enough to get you onto the nominations board and the Oscars. And that's where the campaign comes into play. Now, there are lots of rules in place around how you campaign. You know, you're not supposed to campaign directly to Academy members. You can't ring them up and ask for their vote. You can send out messages, but they have to go through a kind of intermediary, and you can only do it once a week. And a lot of these were actually brought in because of the tricks that Harvey Weinstein used in his campaigns. The Academy had to go back and say, OK, you're not allowed to do
this. So were there no rules back then?
There were rules, but they weren't nearly as tight. Okay. And like, so for example, the screeners thing, you can't send screeners out to them anymore. You have to upload them to the Academy's right. centralized system.
Can you send them stuff?
No,
money.
You can have screenings, but in the nomination phase, you can't have excessive food or drink is the rule. When you are nominated and you're having a screening, you're not even allowed to give them a bottle of water if they come to your screening.
Okay, no sandwiches.
No sandwiches, no, you know, fine dining and all the rest. But there are still lots of little loopholes there that, you know, so you have these Q&A events, you have these, you know, workshops and you have these talks. You'd have, you know, an orchestral rendition of the film score and so on. And, you know, apart from one of the things Harvey Weinstein did was, he told the actors, make yourselves available for the months leading up to the Oscar nominations, because I'm going to have you at all of these events. I'm going to mm-hmm. invite people along. You're going to sit there and talk about your process and talk about the film. Like, one of the things he did for My Left Foot was he got Daniel Day-Lewis to appear before Congress to talk about disabilities. And that was part of his campaign for My Left Foot for the Oscar nomination.
Right.
There. So,
clever.
You know, lots of loopholes still, even with the rules that are there in place.
So you're saying, Brian, that became the blueprint. So we probably have other examples since then where people went all out to try and win an Oscar, and it worked, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the case in the most recent example, I would say this is Emilia Perez. You know, Netflix have basically determined that they are going to get an Oscar by hook or by crook. And in fact, they actually bought out, I think it was an awards consultancy for something like 30 million. Mm-hmm. And now just are running this campaign to get Emilia Perez into the Oscars. And it seems to kind of backfire on them a little bit.
What a mess that is.
Because, I mean, the reality of it is that, like, when you see the film Emilia Perez, I mean, it's a highly divisive film. I didn't like it. I mean, actually, I was here
last
week.
You were here telling us how much you didn't like
Correct,
it.
Correct, yeah. And Dee Malumbi loved it. Or she liked it, at least. Maybe I'm putting words in her mouth, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah. it is a very divisive film, but they've just decided, no, this is going to be an Oscar film. We're going to make this an Oscar. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I say this as a film critic myself, it has become more apparent to me, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years that the Oscars are not really a reliable barometer of what makes a good movie anymore. Because the fact of it is that it's, as Adam pointed out there, actors generally tend to vote for films that have very much about performance, and it's very about, like, you know, what the actors do, and it's less about the spectacle, the technicalities.
I would probably agree with you. I think most people would, from a critic's perspective, yeah. or from a viewer's perspective. But there's no doubt, and maybe Adam, you can talk about this, that if you win an Oscar for whatever, actor, director, whatever, your film's going to go gangbusters after that, right? I mean,
huge... Yeah, not so much anymore.
Really? No.
That used to be the case, and you know, there'd be a timing of the Oscar release so that you'd get the nomination, it would still be in the cinemas, and then you'd get a big bump on the back of that. But that doesn't really happen anymore, partially because films don't stay in the cinemas for as long as they used to. Mm. But there's also no back end anymore with DVD sales and things like that. People will know, oh, that's Oscar nominated, it must be a very worthwhile film. It'll be on Netflix or Disney in the near future. I'll watch it then at some stage. So films don't get that box office boost that they used to get from an Oscar nomination or an Oscar win.
But given that everything has transferred now to streamers, is that not where the action is? You're saying if I have a film that I can put on my Disney Plus platform that has Academy Award winner, I'm going to get more subscribers.
Well, it is, what Netflix has been trying desperately to do. Like, they're desperate to get the Best Picture award win. They've had a number of nominations. They spent something like $40 million on Roma back in, I think it was 2019, mm-hmm. on that film alone, thinking they'd get the Best Picture nod. They still haven't yet. Yeah, but again, you know, like with all of these things, when you're on the platform, it becomes kind of just part of the furniture very quickly. You might, you know, you move on. Mm-hmm. It's probably not going to convince you to hit play on that, and it's certainly not going to convince you to continue to subscribe just because it has an Oscar nominated or an Oscar winning film on the platform.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just about prestige. I mean, that's it, because like, box office doesn't really matter anymore, because the only films that are actually kind of making money are like big stupid blockbusters, like, you know, Captain America, whatever. So in the case of like Netflix or Apple TV or Prime Video or any of these places, the reason why they want an Oscar is because it gives a prestige, gives a level of sort of gravitas. And that then gets reflected into, you know, their stock portfolio and all the rest of it. Like the fact that, oh, well, we've got, you know, an Oscar winning film that's exclusively on this, and that's how much of
added
our work.
Added value.
Yeah, added value and all this kind of jazz, yeah.
We've spoken about positive campaigns. Mm. What about the negative campaigns, Adam? The dirty tricks?
Yeah, well, I mean, Harvey Weinstein is a great example of that. And part of his campaign with Shakespeare in Love was to talk about how Saving Private Ryan was only really the first 15 minutes. You know, it was only that Omaha Beach landing. The rest of the film was kind of boring. This was part of the kind of negative tricks to talk that film down. His company was also part of an attempt to derail the Oscar hopes of A Beautiful Mind, the Russell Crowe film about the Nobel Prize winner, winning mathematician John Nash. That got 8 nominations in 2002. Rumours then started spreading about Nash himself, lots of things about his character being questioned and so on. The Los Angeles Times said it was a representative of Miramax that drew their attention to these, Miramax being Harvey Weinstein's company, drew their attention to these rumours, turned out to be unfounded, some of it based on things he said when he was schizophrenic. Miramax's In the Bedroom was nominated in that year in a number of categories alongside A Beautiful Mind, so clearly they had a vested interest. Now, they apologised, and Weinstein, you know, rang the company and said sorry about that, but, you know, clearly it was part of the playbook for them as well. There have also been other negative tricks, like also this one directed at Miramax, actually, the rumour that Good Will Hunting wasn't actually written by Matt Damon.
Yeah, William Goldman,
That was a Miramax film, so, you know, the tricks returned on Weinstein's company as well.
Well, now I'm wondering, is Emilia Perez a victim of negative campaigning
this year? Some people have been saying that. I mean, there was a whole thing about The Brutalist as well, that the sound editor had used this AI software to tweak certain parts of Adrian Brody's pronunciation of Hungarian vowels. And then there was this big storm in a teacup that, oh, you know, this is the first film to openly admit using generative AI and it's absolutely ridiculous. And, like, you know, we're fighting against artificial intelligence. And then there was more stuff about the fact that they apparently used, in The Brutalist, it's all about architecture, you know, it's all about, like, artistic compromise and da 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 da. And apparently it was rumoured that generative AI was used in the early stages of ideation for some of the sketches.
Well, we have to question all of that. Listen, I have to take a break. Thank you so much for coming in, Brian Lloyd and Adam McGuire.